This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Author and activist Edwige Dancica often reflects on ideas of home and belonging. Edwige was born in Haiti and lived there till she was 12. For many of those years, her parents were living in the U.S. For Edwige, the move to the U.S. was disorienting, and she turned to books for comfort. Now, her experience as an immigrant of color informs her writing and her activism. Edwige is a regular contributor to The New Yorker magazine and an author of several books, including her latest memoir, The Art of Death, Writing the Final Story. She's going to deliver the 25th annual Sonia Haynes Stone Memorial Lecture tomorrow evening at the Sonia Haynes Stone Center for Black Culture and History at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. But first, she joins me on The State of Things. Edwige Dancica, what a pleasure. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's nice being with you.
I want to talk about your lecture in a few minutes, but I want to take a few minutes to get to know you. You grew up near Port-au-Prince, Haiti. Your parents moved to the United States while you were young. What took them to the U.S.?
Well, my parents moved to the U.S. during the Duvalier dictatorship, which was a father and son dictatorship that lasted 30 years in Haiti. It was a combination of political and economic issues for them. And my mom left when I was four, my dad when I was two, and I joined them in New York when I was 12 in 1981.
Just to give us some idea of what it would be like to live under Papa Doc and Baby Doc and the Tonton Macou, perhaps you can, I know there's a story that you're, many stories, but your father always living in peril as a shoemaker in a shoe repair shop. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, my dad, when we would ask him sort of the pivotal moment when he decided to leave Haiti, he used to tell us the story of working in a shoe shop, and the Duvalier's henchmen, the Tonton Macoutes, would come in and they would want the best shoes from the shop. And then the shop owner, who otherwise would go out of business because, you know, they could not be denied anything, the Tonton Macoutes, if they came in. And so he started having my dad sort of fit them with these cheaper shoes. And my father was always afraid that if one of them caught on, that he would shoot him. So he sort of tells that story of being at the foot of a Tonton Macou trying to fit a shoe on his foot and realizing that he could, you know, if anything were to go wrong, lose his life over that one moment. And there were many moments like that for people living under dictatorship, you know, small or large moments that could end your life. And so he decided at that point to leave the country.
So for understandable reasons, obviously they leave the country, but you're living your first 12 years in Haiti without them. What was that like for you?
Well, it wasn't an uncommon story because my parents, like a lot of new immigrants, you know, they're not sure what they were coming to, and they really didn't, child care, for example, would have been a big issue. My mom, they needed to work, and my mom had to work. She had she spent a lot of her time, most of her life in America, working in textile factories, you're making purses or clothes and things of that nature. But so they left me with my aunt and uncle, and even though, you know, the country, there was still the dictatorship, but they felt like my uncle could protect us, and he did, and we lived in his house with many other young children who were in the same position as we were.
And, of course, your parents were sending money, so that meant you had school supplies and fees and all of that for those 12 years.
Oh, yeah. My parents, I mean, I think this is why parents, you know, they make this journey in the first place. So they were sending money for our clothes, for our food, and they were also supporting other family members, and while sending us to school, were also paying for the school of other children. So that's just the story of immigration, especially from places like Haiti, and that for every person who is here, there are quite a few people relying on their labor. So they're also supporting themselves here, but and also quite a few of people back home at the same time.
Yeah, and that gets to some of the questions that I know occupy your thoughts and your writing, this question of identity and memory and these kinds of tensions that divide our sense of identity and place and belonging. These are very important to you as a writer, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. Because, I think especially all of these questions become magnified in light of migration or immigration, or to somebody picking up and living the only place they've ever known. And really, they're doing it on faith and on their ability to work, and just really they're taking a big gamble, not just with their own lives, but with the future of their children at times. So those questions, you know, dominate my life, my thoughts quite a bit, because they've been at the center of my life. I've seen them in action. I've seen also the kind of resistance and scapegoating, especially in the time that we live in now, that immigrants get at the same time that they're here, you know, trying to contribute, trying to work, and trying to make a better life for themselves in a way that also intersect with being productive members of this society.
Yeah, we just saw a report that had been just recently released, although it had been done a few months ago, out of the White House, that shows a $63 billion net gain to the U.S. Treasury because of refugees to this country. The White House is denying the validity of that report. But in fact, it was a White House report on that's just the monetary value. But also, perhaps for people who have not been displaced, for people who have been living here, may not quite understand or fully appreciate the sense of vulnerability that you have if you have been displaced and find yourself living here. You're planning on sharing your reflections on the violence that people of color face in the U.S. Tell us a little bit more about that, because I understand that when you first went to Brooklyn at 12 years old, you didn't sense that as much, and then it was only later that you began to realize how discrimination and violence works.
Well, I think there one of the things that Professor Haynes Stone worked on was history and culture, and this sort of in the center is a celebration of her legacy. And one of the things that I wanted to do in my talk was kind of bring together these intersections of where our stories meet as members of the African diaspora. So as a Haitian immigrant here, I'm coming here from the first Black Republic in the Western Hemisphere, you know, Haiti. And there is a place, actually, I think in North Carolina called Haiti. There's a town, sort of a former Black town that was named after Haiti post-independence. I think people call it Haiti.
The Haiti neighborhood of Durham is a robust African-American neighborhood with a deep history, yes. And it was named for Haiti.
Yeah. Yes, and so I wanted to bring in that talk in my talk tomorrow, to bring together these kinds of things where in the diaspora we intersect, both in sort of in the celebration of Sartre, through people like Professor Haynes Stone, people like James Baldwin, but also in moments, you know, in these painful moments of state or vigilante violence that also connect us. So I wanted to try to sort of bridge certain gaps, because often, you know, the misconception of Black immigrants sometimes when they come here is that we might tend to sort of take on, along with the general society, sort of like the mental of a kind of racism of our own, because we might sort of repeat things we've heard about, you know, why certain things are a certain way. So I really wanted to talk about places where we can bridge those gaps, and both in our joys and in our pains.
So this is something like the sort of the good immigrant phenomenon, where you've made it and your family has made it as recent immigrants, and perhaps there might be a tendency to disassociate yourself with African Americans or others who are being scapegoated in this country.
Well, I think that happens to some people. That didn't happen in our case, because when I came here, I was, you know, part of a Caribbean and African American community, and we had sort of more overlap in the building that we lived in, and there was immediately, you know, certain sympathies established. But it does happen with other, you know, with a lot of immigrant groups, including Black immigrant groups. And one of the things, you know, Toni Morrison wrote a wonderful essay some years ago where she talks about, for a lot of new immigrant groups, the way that they become assimilated is by sort of taking on the mental of racism and superiority. And so this is not part of my purview per se, but I think it's something that as immigrants, you know, newly arrived immigrants to keep an eye on, that there's so much to learn from the African-American experience in this country. People all over the world are inspired. They were, you know, in South Africa and other places where there were racial struggles. People are inspired by the civil rights movement and the history of this country, just in the same way that a lot of people around the world were inspired by the story of the Haitian Revolution in 1804. So for me, making those connections generally in my thought and somewhat in the talk that I'll give tomorrow is just a very important thing, because I think we're stronger together than we are splintered.
And of course, the story of immigration in the United States is one that it's a tortured history, and one that we haven't quite fully come to grips with in terms of understanding whether to embrace it or to distance ourselves from it. I know that for instance, your uncle is someone who followed all the rules when it comes to immigration. He visited the U.S. from Haiti dozens of times, and then ended up dying in an immigration center. Tell us his story.
Yeah, a couple of years ago, my uncle, who had been coming back and forth to visit the U.S. for over 30 years, was 81 years old, and there had been some trouble in Haiti at that time, and when he arrived at the airport in Miami, he was asked how long he would be staying. He tried to explain that he would be longer than the 30-day visa allowed. And so he asked for what he termed to temporary asylum. And so he was arrested. He was detained. His medication was taken away. And he died 5 days later, chained to a hospital bed in the prison ward of Jackson Memorial Hospital here. So the thing is, I think his is one of many cases. And we've been reading, there's so many cases around the country since his case and other cases where you have the medical care and detention is so deplorable that people are allowed to die in that way. And they don't have they're not covered by any kind of civil liberties necessarily, because they're in transit, they're not citizens, they're not residents. So there's nothing really that covers people like my uncle. So he ended up dying in the custody of Homeland Security. I mean, the thing about, I think, immigration, even in the way the conversation is being had today, is that, you know, the sort of this schizophrenic relationship with immigration in this country, where people say we're a country of immigrants, but no more. And sometimes you see lawmakers, I live in Florida, in Miami, where you see people whose grandparents would not have even been allowed to enter if they were lawmakers at that time. So I think there's that, always that contradiction, and it's always a bit more complex if you're an immigrant also from a poor black country. I mean, like Haiti, that also adds another layer to sort of resistance to your presence, and I think that's something that's gotten even more complicated. For example, with an issue like temporary protected status, where something like 56,000 people in January might lose that status. And DACA, you know, the Deferred Childhood Arrival executive order by President Obama, that might also go away. So it's a very precarious time, I think, for immigrants right now.
You talked earlier about a certain amount of empathy. You talked about those from the African diaspora when you were all living together in Brooklyn. There was a certain amount of sympathy that you developed and perhaps immunized you from the tendency to want to step away from or distance yourself from others, people of color in this country. This idea of empathy, I think, is now and sympathy. Perhaps playing out a little bit larger on a different theater when we think about the number of hurricanes that had certainly disproportionately, or in terms of their impact, affected Caribbean countries. But now we're seeing more and more here on the coast of the United States. And I wonder if that'll have an impact on how we understand refugee status. I mean, just people moving, the idea that not being in your place has a profound effect on how you feel about yourself and your sense of security.
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, even as we're speaking right now, we have Hurricane Maria, who just devastated Dominica and is heading for Puerto Rico. And we don't know what else. And we've just seen Harvey, and we've seen Irma. And I think all of these, you know, these events that are becoming so frequent. You know, a Category 5 hurricane is just so common now. And every other week we have a 500-year storm, a so-called 500-year storm. I think it just also speaks to the precarity of it's a very similar precarity to what a lot of people in poor countries have been dealing with for a very long time. But I think that it should remind us all that we do share this planet, and that a lot of our behaviors, unfortunately, and sort of the so-called developing world, we're a lot of people in the developing world suffer more harsher consequences from climate change. They're not as prepared. They don't have the same resources to recover as quickly. You know, we've seen the devastation with Irma, and who knows how long that will take in some of these places. But I think it also brings this to our doorstep that we share this planet, and some of us have more resources to recover, and some of us have fewer resources, but the same things are happening to us. And if you live in a state like Florida, you don't forget that these hurricanes go through the Caribbean and they come here and they circle back. And so it reminds us that we're all part of this circle, and we're this precarity. And the same way that, you know, from the climate and from Mother Nature does not discriminate.
Edwige, what a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Edwige Dantzika is a Haitian-American author and activist, a regular contributor to The New Yorker, and author of several books, including her latest, a memoir, The Art of Death, Writing the Final Story. She delivers the 25th annual Sonia Haynes Stone Memorial Lecture. That's tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock at the Sonia Haynes Stone Center for Black Culture and History at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. That event is free and open to the public, and we have information at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton-Orman, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brooklyn. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.